Welcome to the show. This is It's Your Money, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the financial services industry and exposes the truth about money and investing. My name is Paul Nichols, and I'm joined by Deb Seward. Hi, Deb. How
are
you doing?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. We are going to go ahead and do a podcast called Separating Myths. For those of you that are regular listeners, you know that we normally bring some contrarian material to you on a regular basis. This would not be any different. In fact, we believe that there is a scientific and academic approach to investing in the market. You don't have to rely on talking heads or news articles or whatever. We are your only source. This is the only source that you will need moving forward to really understand what it is that academic investing can bring to the table, and the peace of mind that may come from education, that often comes from clarity, that is a result of confidence, that is, of that education, and it can lead to peace of mind, and that's really what we're all about. So today what we want to do is really break down the myths that are holding people back, we believe really hurting people in their portfolios, and talk about an academic approach to investing. So let's start out by just firing off the four myths, and I'm going to break each one of them down. Deb, what are the four myths?
Okay. One is stock selection. Second is track record investing. The third is market timing. And the last is cost of investing.
So, Deb, if somebody walked into the office and said, hey, how's BP going to do moving forward? Or how's Exxon going to do? What they're really doing is asking us to make a
prediction.
Or to select a stock. Well, if we knew what was going to happen moving forward, would we need to be available for that prediction?
No, I don't think I'd be here, Paul.
I'd probably be on the beach. In fact, St. Bart's with the laptop. How about you?
Yeah, okay. Ditto.
So obviously, stock selection, we're going to break each of these down. Another prediction that people want us to make, they walk in the office and say, hey, Paul, what's the hot manager right now? Well, Deb, what do you think?
Well, I think there's no real ability for a manager to perform in the future, in the future like they have in the past. In fact, there's a disclosure on every magazine I've ever seen that says past performance is not a guarantee of future results.
So really, track record investing, does it really work? Number three, market timing. That is trying to decide, should we put money in the market? Should we take it out? Again, another prediction. So a lot of these myths have really been propagated by the industry through the years, and we have not found any empirical research to prove them out at all. In fact, we have found a boatload of research, predominantly from Dalbar, Morningstar, and the Center for Research and Security Pricing out of the University of Chicago to, in fact, debunk what the vast majority of advisors are doing, and that is predicting how great their research department is, determining triggers, saying that we have a defensive portfolio for this time. It's nothing but prediction, guessing at its very core. And I believe that it's incredible speculation and risk that you're taking by following some of these myths, which is why we want to dispel them for you today. Let's start with stock selection. What is the definition of stock selection, Deb, when we start to look at stock selection?
It's really the investment advisors, the definition you said.
Yeah, the definition.
Okay, it's choosing stocks that are believed that will do well in the future.
So the definition of stock selection is choosing stocks that are believed to do well in the future. Well, what is the myth?
The myth is that investment advisors can consistently and predictably add value by exercising superior skill in individual stock selection.
Here's what we see on a regular basis. It doesn't matter really what study we look to, but it falls right around in the area, and I'm going to give you just general numbers here, in the area of about 15%, or only about 15% of the managers beat the market half the time. That means 85% don't even get market returns. So there's no proof in the pudding as it relates to stock selection. So how many of you would gamble on a 15% hit rate?
Not me.
Not me either. Let's take us to our second myth. What's the definition of track record investing?
The use of performance history to determine the best investment for the future.
The myth is finding funds that did well in the past is a reliable method of indicating which funds will do well in the future. You know, it doesn't really matter what time frame we look at, Deb, but whenever we look at a time frame, let's say 1986 to 1985, and just grab that, about a 10-year time frame, it would not be uncommon that in 1992, 93, 94, 95, these top 20 mutual funds, we're talking about the top 20 mutual funds in that 10-year time frame, it would not be uncommon for advisors, any advisor's office you walked into, for them to sell you that fund, would it?
No.
Because it's hot. It's hot right now.
That's right.
That's what the market does. It chases what's hot. Well, would you agree in a well-diversified portfolio, you're going to have areas that aren't hot?
That's right.
You should have mundane earnings in part of your portfolio. All of it can't be hot. You're chasing the market, and that's what we want to avoid. So what's interesting, when we look at any time frame, the 20 top mutual funds, and look for them to repeat, it is extremely rare to ever find a repeat. But in fact, what we normally see is a stellar return for the top 20 mutual funds, and then when we look at it 10 years later, it dropped like a rock.
That's right. I've seen that a lot.
I have bought funds that have done that.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Okay? You buy a fund, you go to Morningstar, you research it. Okay, track record looks good. Buy it and then watch it tank. It's probably never happened to any of you, but it's happened to me personally. That brings us to our third myth, which would be market timing. What's the definition, Deb?
Any attempt to alter or change the mix of assets based on a prediction or forecast about the future.
Money managers, the myth would be then, money managers are able to utilize market timing to effectively predict up and down markets. Well, there's no research whatsoever to prove it out. In fact, if you take any 10-year time frame in the market, there's approximately 2,520 trading days. So we're going to use the S&P in our example, January 1, 1989 to December 31st, 2008. If you took $10,000 or whatever and invested it in the market, by the way, that was a 20-year time frame, not a 10-year time frame, 1989 to December 08. If we looked at putting money in during that time frame and holding it during the whole time frame and not touching it, we have about an 8%, 8.5% return. But if we miss just the best 5 days out of that 20-year period in the market, our returns are cut in half. If we miss the best 10 days in 20 years, ladies and gentlemen, our return is barely above zero. And if we miss the best 15 days out of 20 years by trying to market time the market in and out, we actually have a negative return. You know, it reminds me back in October, I believe it was, Deb, of 2008, we had a Friday where the market dropped 800 points. There was over a billion. The volume was out of control. A lot of people obviously were getting out of the market. The next Monday, we had an 1,100-point run-up, almost 1,100 points, a little over 1,000 points, about 11% increase in the market. What happens to those poor people that sold out on Friday because their broker does not understand that market timing is a myth?
Well, they sold when it was low, and then they couldn't recoup that cost because by the time they got back in, it was already higher.
They weren't even closed out. If they sold on Friday, they didn't even get their money till the following couple
right.
of days, right? So, I mean, folks, this is a huge mistake. Huge mistake. And it's really lucrative for the industry, which leads us to our final myth, which is what, Deb?
Cost of investing, which means fees that are incurred by investors to buy, sell, and own stocks or mutual funds.
The myth is what you don't see can't hurt you. This is the dirty little secret. This is what they don't want you to know, okay? And it's something called the bid-ask spread. Now, don't say that too fast, boys and girls. The bid-ask spread. What does that mean? Well, that means if, Deb, let's say I'm going to sell a share of GE. What do I got to do?
You have to find someone that will be willing to buy it.
Through the market.
Right. And has to go through Wall Street. So there's always a buy price as well as a sell price. So let's say if you're going to sell it, you're going to get about $49 if it's a $50 stock, and then I might be able to buy it on the other end for $50.
So that's something called the bid-ask spread. Who keeps the difference? Or the spread?
The Wall Street.
Wall Street does. So would it be advantageous to Wall Street to have a lot more volume in any given day?
Well, that would be a yes.
Well, that would directly lead to revenue, would it not?
Sure.
And let me ask you something. What's interesting is where is all this bid-ask spread reported? It's never reported anywhere except in the variable trading cost and the statement of additional information, which is an additional document part of the prospectus. Now, here's where I'm going to go out on a limb a little bit and say I think the industry is a little bit shifty in this regard. Here's how it works. At the end of every day is when they take all those trading costs right off the top. And the money that's left is divided by the shares that are left for the price for the next day.
Which mean the investors, we all pay for that.
So for those of you who didn't catch that, the subtleness of that, let me hit you with it again. At the end of the trading day, they take all the bid-ask spread cost off the top of the bucket of money. They take the bucket of money that's left and divide it by the shares. We're referring to mutual funds here, okay? Buy it by the shares that are left, and that's the cost for the fund the next day. We're not talking about individual stock, but mutual funds. Now, it's called bid-ask spread with individual stock, but it's called NAV and POP with mutual funds. What's NAV and POP stand for?
Net asset value and public offering price.
So you get the net asset value, which would be after the trading cost, or all the trading cost is conveniently pulled off the top, which does lower the value, right?
Sure.
Okay, and then the public offering price would be that new price the next day. So these are the four myths that are propagated by the industry, and the vast majority of times they're propagated by people that really don't know about this stuff in the industry because they've listened to the broker-dealer that they work with, the large institution or insurance company or bank or wirehouse or brokerage firm that has been helping them facilitate their practice for their clients' benefit. So what happens for many people, let's go back to the rule of 72 real quick.
Okay.
If I may, I'm going to digress just for a moment to make a point. The rule of 72 is basically something you can do in your head to figure out, just mathematically in your head, what kind of yield you will get based on the amount of time that you're dealing with. So, for example, Deb, if I had the rule of 72, I've got 10 years. 10 years into 72 gives me what yield for that 10 years?
7.2%.
You see that, ladies and gentlemen? Let's say that I was getting 9% in my portfolio. How often would it take for my money to double?
About what, 8 years?
8 times 9 is 72. So mm-hmm. You get the deal. So here's my question to you, ladies and gentlemen. Many of you out there think you're getting 10, 11, 12% returns. I'm sorry to be the messenger here, but that's gross, not net. That's gross, not net, okay? Because the fact of the matter is, if you're getting 10% in your portfolio, then it should be doubling every 7 years?
7.2 years.
That's without any more contributions.
That's okay? Right.
I want to submit to you the question, is your portfolio doubling every 7, 8, 9, 10? Probably not. It's probably more like every 12 to 15 years. That's been my observation. How about you, Deb?
Yep, about the same.
So what does that mean? Well, people aren't getting 10% like they think they're getting. They're probably getting 6 or 7 after fees.
And the gross might be 10, 12%, but the miscellaneous fees that Paul and I just talked about is really what works on your performance.
And we're not talking about a half a point or 1 point or 2 points. We're often talking about 2 to 4 points on a regular basis. And this comes from Charles Ellis, who is best-selling author of Winning at the Loser's Game and professor from Harvard, MBA at Princeton. Some big brains we're dealing with. And I'm telling you, when you look at the numbers, it may sound good on paper, but what it means to real cash in your pocket, I would venture to say that very few of out there listening to this is having your money double every 12 years. It's probably closer to every 15 years. This has been my experience in analyzing thousands of portfolios. I don't know, what's your experience been, Deb?
It's been the same, Paul. It's been pretty amazing whenever I do analyze a portfolio. And you'll often find people saying, well, I thought I was getting 10%. And then we go back to that rule of 72. Well, is your money doubling every 7 years? And it's an overwhelmingly no.
Every 10 years, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever. Again, it's a rule of 72. Whatever the yield you think you're getting, divide it by 72, and that's how many years it should take to double your portfolio. And if it's not doubling that quickly, ladies and gentlemen, then you're not getting the yield you think you're getting. Thou shalt not fake thyself out. That's the 11th commandment. Thou shalt not fake thyself out. And if you do, shame on you. We want to pull back the curtain so you don't have to worry about that anymore. So let's get into the story of investing. We want to talk about an academic approach to investing. If we know the myths don't work, it would be unconscionable of us to sit here on a podcast and tell you everything that doesn't work without coming back with what does.
Right.
Okay? So let's talk about it. First of all, let's talk about free markets work. Lay that on me, Deb.
In a free market, at any point in time, the actual price of a security will be a good estimate of its intrinsic value.
There's basically two camps out there, ladies and gentlemen. You may not be aware of this, But many of you have never determined what your investment philosophy is. I'm not talking about your investment objective, conservative, aggressive. I'm talking about your philosophy. And the investment philosophy is basically two camps. Do you believe the market is efficient, or do you believe the market is inefficient? In other words, do you believe the market works, or do you believe the market fails? And let me give you an example. I'm going to go with market works. You go with market fails.
Okay.
So if free markets work, I believe that based on supply and demand, free markets are the best determinant of market prices, that all available information is factored into the current price. Only new and unknowable information ever changes the pricing or events, maybe that might happen, like a Bear Stearns. And the randomness of the market makes it impossible for any individual or entity to consistently predict market movement and capture additional return unrelated to risk. People with this view would utilize free market investment strategies. So this is what, by the way, Eugene Fama got international acclaim for back in the 60s when he wrote Random Walks in Stock Prices, which was in the Financial Analyst Journal back in 1965. It really changed the way some of us believe about what's happening in the market. But unfortunately, the majority of the market still propagates and practices the belief that the market fails. And what would that belief be, Deb?
Well, if you believe that the market does not work, that it fails, you would say the market fails to price goods and services accordingly or accurately. It is possible for some individuals to identify in advance which prices are inaccurate, and underpriced and overvalued markets can be forecasted or predicted. And by taking advantage of these mispricings, either in stocks or market sectors, it is possible to both increase returns and avoid losses in investments.
So basically, we have two opposing beliefs. Beliefs here, okay? Now, here's what's interesting. Beliefs dictate actions. Beliefs dictate actions. If I believe the market's efficient and all the prices and are all figured in that a pack of gums goes for what the free market is willing to pay for a pack of gum or a bag of peanuts or a bottle of soda, I believe that there's going to be actions as a result of these beliefs. And those actions would be, if I believe the market is efficient and works, I want to focus on capturing market returns. I want to basically diversify prudently, own the entire marketplace, because it's kind of like it reminds me of the suntan lotion and umbrellas. You know, we never know whether it's going to be rainy or sunny in any given day, okay? So we want to be prepared. So in a well-diversified portfolio, I'm going to own suntan lotion and umbrellas. If I believe the market was inefficient, I would own whichever one I thought was going to go up. So free market fail beliefs would dictate what actions.
You would pursue traditional investment strategies and stay connected to all sources of financial information. Read every article, watch every TV show that you can about it, and work with a financial professional who shares that type of belief.
So really, folks, most of you probably never thought that you got to have an investment philosophy. You either believe the market's efficient or it's not efficient, okay? And now those beliefs are going to dictate your actions. Because look, if you believe the market was inefficient, you better never own an index fund, right?
That's right.
If you believe the market is efficient, then you probably would own index funds, okay? If you believe the market was inefficient, you would never own index funds, but you would constantly be reading and trying to figure out ahead of time the direction that the market's moving. Well, we haven't seen very good results in that area. So let's go on to component number two of free market portfolio theory. The first one is markets work. We believe the market's efficient and it works. Thereby, we want to invest accordingly and own accordingly and own the entire marketplace. So that brings us to component number two, which we practice wholeheartedly, and that is modern portfolio theory. Now, this was groundbreaking, a revolutionary study. Revolutionary? That's not right. What am I saying? A revolutionary? What's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know. I think you're doing well.
Okay. This modern portfolio theory, the whole concept, basically came from three Nobel laureates, Harry Markowitz, William Sharpe, and Merton Miller. And very simply, Harry Markowitz realized back in the 50s when he wrote a PhD dissertation and an article for the Journal of Finance that mathematically he believed that risk and reward, risk should be measured and quantified by understanding dissimilar price movement. Dissimilar price movement basically means that I don't know whether it's going to be raining or I don't know whether the sun's going to be shining, but I'm going to own the kind of stocks that are going to give me growth in either environment, right?
That's correct.
I don't want to get too heavy. Modern portfolio theory is a concept of understanding the market's efficient, owning all aspects of the market, and realizing you're going to hit whatever's up. You're also going to be a part of whatever's down, but the market is like going up the flight of stairs with the yo-yo. It goes up over time. It has a two-thirds bias. One out of every 3 years is down. Two out of every 3 years is up. We just don't know which is the one and which is the two.
That's correct.
There goes the rub, okay? And that leads us to the last component, which is?
The three-factor model. And really what that composed of is not only being the market as a factor, but the size is a factor as well as value.
So basically what happened was a couple professors by the name of Kenneth French and Eugene Fama, it's been about 80s, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, went out and said, where do returns come from? Not what are the determinants of return, but where do returns come from? And they basically created the largest database, which is now the Chicago, the Center for Research and Security Pricing out of the University of Chicago. And what they determined was they figured out where 96% of the variabilities of returns come from. And it was a mixture between three factors. The market, that is, there is a premium for being in the market over cash of 4% to 6%. Premium meaning a gain, okay, or a risk factor, if you will. There is the factor two, which is size, that there's a premium for owning small companies over large companies of 1% to 3%. And then value. There's a premium for owning value companies over growth companies of about 2 to 4%. By the way, the difference between a value and a growth company, very simply, a growth company would be a Walmart. They're doing very well, good share price, good dividends. They get the best deal when they go to borrow money. A value company, it's an old example, but a good example, would be like Kmart. Kmart right. was distressed. They weren't a bad company, but you should get a higher return for investing in Kmart over a Walmart. So very simply, that's the idea of the value factor. So basically, we're going to have to kind of end it there, Deb, at this point, because to get into anything else really is visual, okay? Mm-hmm. So basically, what I would like to do is just kind of leave it here at this point. What we've been discussing is separating myths from truth, the story of investing, and what we have basically, and let me summarize, we talked about four traditional investing myths, that is stock selection, track record investing, market timing, and the cost of investing, and how that may drag down and create issues. Of course, from a research viewpoint, there's no science to prove out that we should pursue those techniques.
Right.
Okay. But rather, what we suggest is not to pursue those, but rather to understand that the market's efficient, that modern portfolio, the science has proved out in the last 60 years and it works, and the three-factor model tells us where the variability of returns come from in the market. And when we apply the science, what we have is very well diversified portfolios that capture the entire global marketplace, which is all we're trying to do. We're not trying to beat the market. We're trying to get what the market will bear, and some years it's a bear market. Any final comments, Deb?
No, you said that very well.
Thank you. Well, you've been listening to Paul Nichols, known as the Investor Coach, joined by Deb Seward. We are both with Financial Abundance. Financial Abundance is a registered investment advisory firm in central Pennsylvania that is registered directly with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And if you would like to learn more about an academic approach to investing, we encourage you to go to our website, Financial Abundance. Just Google. You can Google Financial Abundance. We come in right at the top. You can go to WJAC-TV. I am the NBC Investor Coach for Central PA. You can go to iTunes. Obviously, you're on iTunes listening to this. So thanks again for listening. Again, you're listening to Paul Nichols and Deb Seward, the Investor Coach, pulling back the curtain on the financial services industry and exposing the truth about money and investing. And I am sorry, I just realized I've probably been talking too fast this whole time. So listen again. Have a great day. Talk to you later.